From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, how Manuel Noriega used the United States, and how the U.S. used Noriega. Journalist John Dingus has just written a history of Noriega's relationship with the U.S., called Our Man in Panama. Also today, we meet actor Peter Riegert. He played a pickle vendor in Crossing the Lancy. In his new movie, he gets to play a ruthless executive. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles The Five Keys, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Joe vs. the Volcano, the new comedy starring Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The nationalist majority in Lithuania's parliament is preparing to declare independence from the Soviet Union this weekend. A spokeswoman for the pro-independence Sąjūdis movement said today that the parliament would actually vote to reaffirm the declaration of an independent Lithuanian state first made in 1918. Spokeswoman Rita Dapkus said that Lithuania would then have a legal basis to begin negotiations with Moscow as an independent state. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl visited a meeting of NATO ambassadors in Brussels to brief them on German unification plans. Deirdre Berger has more.
Diplomats in Brussels say there is growing uneasiness among some European governments with the rapid pace of German unification and the minimal consultation by Bonn with its European allies. To counter those concerns, West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl went to Brussels today to reassure his NATO partners about West German border intentions. The NATO ambassadors welcomed the resolution passed earlier today in the West German parliament acknowledging the permanence of the Polish-German border. Kohl came under sharp criticism in parliament for his earlier refusal to clearly recognize the border as binding. Hans-Jochen Vogel, head of the opposition Social Democrats, said Kohl's behavior had turned West German politics into a risk factor in Europe. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Cologne.
President Bush and Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner outlined a new transportation policy today to revitalize the nation's road, rail, and air systems. Critics say the plan will shift the burden for transportation costs from the federal governments to the states. NPR's Brian Naylor has this report.
The administration says the first national transportation policy in a dozen years is designed to ease the growing congestion on the nation's highways and airports. No price tag is affixed to the plan, which calls for modernizing interstate highways and the air traffic control system. Transportation Secretary Skinner denied the charge that the plan will force states and localities to raise taxes because Washington won't.
We feel that the state and local governments have not provided a sufficient amount of infrastructure funding. They're willing to raise their user fees. They have raised their user fees. They have stepped up to the plate and been very effective in doing so. And by doing so, they can play a greater role.
The average state gasoline tax is now 16 cents a gallon, double what it was 10 years ago. The federal gas tax has stood at 9 cents a gallon since 1982. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
A group of 11 senators has urged Labor Secretary Elizabeth Dole to intercede in the Greyhound strike. No talks are underway between Greyhound Lines and its striking bus drivers and other employees. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 26 points to finish at 2,696.17. Advances led decliners in active trading. This is NPR News. A government prosecutor charged today that former National Security Advisor John Poindexter lied to Congress and destroyed a key presidential document to cover up the Iran-Contra scandal. In his opening argument in the Poindexter trial, prosecutor Dan Webb told jurors that Poindexter's former aide, Oliver North, will testify that he lied to Congress on Poindexter's instructions. U.S. District Judge Harold Green ruled that the prosecution could put North on the stand and ask him about the destruction of the presidential finding on the arms sale to Iran. An out-of-court settlement has been reached in the case of Veronica Prego, a New York doctor who claims she contracted AIDS from a carelessly discarded needle. The terms of the settlement were kept secret by a judge's gag order. Carol Zimmer reports.
2 hours after summations were scheduled to begin in Dr. Prego's $175 million negligence suit against Brooklyn's Kings County Hospital, the judge in the case announced that a settlement had been reached. Before he dismissed the jurors, Judge Aaron Bernstein told them that they had made the settlement possible, then placed a gag order on disclosing the amount. During the two-month trial, an economist testified that Dr. Prego would have earned $20 to $30 million during her lifetime, but experts say the doctor probably has less than a year to live as a result of AIDS. Dr. Prego claimed she contracted the disease from pricking herself on a needle that was carelessly left by another doctor at the hospital. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Zimmer reporting.
The House Ethics Committee said today that it's taking no further action on charges that Georgia Republican Newt Gingrich violated House rules in the promotion of his book. Gingrich, the House Minority Whip, said the decision showed that the charges against him were just political retaliation. Gingrich was a principal accuser in the ethics controversy that forced the resignation of Democratic House Speaker Jim Wright last year. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. General Manuel Noriega, the former military ruler of Panama, is in solitary confinement in the Dade County, Florida jail. He's awaiting trial on drug trafficking charges. The trial was recently postponed to late fall. It was less than 3 months ago, on December 20th, that the U.S. invaded Panama to remove Noriega from power and to enforce two separate drug trafficking indictments against him. As journalist John Dingus writes, never before had the U.S. indicted a foreign official of Noriega's rank and power. The charges against Noriega were even more astounding in light of his history of close cooperation with the U.S. in military intelligence and drug enforcement matters. Dingus reconstructs the history of that cooperation in his new book, Our Man in Panama. John Dingus is a foreign editor at National Public Radio. He's also co-author of a book on the murder of Chilean diplomat Orlando Letelier called Assassination on Embassy Row. I asked Dingus to sum up what Panama's role has been in the Latin American drug trade.
Panama is a transshipment point for everything, blue jeans to drugs to espionage equipment. That's the essence of the country ever since Balboa walked over the isthmus and discovered the Pacific Ocean. It's a place where you take things and move them around. And so it's a natural for drugs. In the early 70s, it was well known that Panama was a link in the French connection. The drugs were coming from the east, France, through South America, and then up through Panama to the United States. A very circuitous route, but one that, had the advantage of confusing detection. And it's at that time that Noriega first gets into the drug trade, and he was actually detected by the United States in 1971, 1972.
Panama has also had bank secrecy laws that makes it easy for drug money to be laundered there.
That happened around the same time that Omar Torrijos took over in a coup in 1968, and it actually was a very progressive government, introduced social reforms, and generally was considered to be a fairly good thing for Panama. One of the things that they did, and of course this was with U.S. encouragement, was to build up a banking center, to have bank laws that would guarantee secrecy and set up a system similar to what you have in Switzerland, the Cayman Islands, Jamaica, those kinds of things. And this is not set up to launder drug money. It's set up to be a tax haven. And, of course, you have any kind of money from skimming at the Las Vegas casinos to off-track betting in New York. Any place where you have a lot of cash to get rid of, people tend to put it in banks like this to avoid paying taxes on it. Drug money was just one more source of cash, and the system was set up for it. And as soon as the cash was there, they started using it.
What has Noriega's personal involvement been that we know of in drugs?
In the early days, he was the man. This is 1971-72. He had taken over as head of intelligence, so he was in charge of immigration, the drug police. And so if you wanted protection to bring in a load of marijuana or to ship it out, you had to pay off Noriega. And so at that point, he was taking fairly direct payoffs. This is a fairly short period of time. But that's the kind of thing he would do. He was never somebody that would actually order a shipload of marijuana or a plane load of cocaine. He was always somebody you had to pay off to do your drug business. So it wasn't that kind of hands-on direct involvement.
But he made a lot of money off of drugs.
He made probably fairly piddling amounts, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, that sort of thing, in the early 70s, and probably wasn't at all something that was his major field of endeavor. He, as I say in the book, he's made a lot more from other kinds of corruption, making foreign businessmen pay off to do business in Panama for using the Canal Free Zone, all sorts of things like that. Arms trafficking, he made a lot of money in arms trafficking. It was always something that he was involved in as one of the things that is easy to do if you're a general in charge of intelligence in a country like Panama. In the 80s, then drugs becomes a billion-dollar business. And at that point, Noriega jumps into the trade again using the network he'd already set up for arms trafficking and begins to make not tens of thousands of dollars but millions of dollars.
John Dinkins is my guest, and he's a foreign editor at NPR and author of the new book, Our Man in Panama, about General Noriega. Nate, you say in spite of Noriega's involvement in the drug trade, he's hardly the drug kingpin that Bush has made him out to be.
Well, we're looking at a case in which the United States has invaded a country in order to enforce an indictment, to bring this man to trial in Miami. Now, that may or may not be a good thing. The politics of that we're going to be debating for years. But if you look at it just as a drug case, this is a man whose maximum involvement, as documented in the U.S. case, is maybe $10 million in drug payoffs. This is nowhere near the involvement of the Ochoas, the Escobars in Colombia, the many, many major drug traffickers who are generating profits of $2 or $3 billion a year. So one has to wonder at the proportion of the response for somebody like Noriega. My feeling, my theory is that, it's not a theory, it's more of an observation, is that we demonized Noriega. We created him as such a terrible, evil man that it was that he personally, his personal evil was used to justify an invasion in which hundreds of lives were lost. And I think that was a terrible misperception of U.S. policy, misapplication of U.S. power.
Well, do you think that drugs are being used to cover up other stories that Noriega has been involved with?
I think that, I don't know if it's a cover-up. It would be hard to assume that there was a cover-up since we actually brought him here and we're going to put him on trial. Many people think that the invasion was targeted on Noriega personally, certainly it was, and that if he had been caught in a firefight and been killed, that would not have been regretted too much within the U.S. Policy planners. It would have been much more convenient if this man had died in the fighting than for him to have turned himself in and basically demanded a trial and the opportunity to reveal the secret that he's learned during a 30-year relationship with U.S. intelligence.
Well, Noriega helped ship arms to the Contras. Do you think there's any connection between Noriega and the Iran-Contra affair?
I think that Noriega had a peripheral connection in the Iran-Contra affair. As you remember from the evidence that came out in the hearings, Panama was the place where the companies were set up that were used in the Iran-Contra transactions. That, of course, doesn't say much because there are 100,000 secret companies set up in Panama all the time. The fact that there was this kind of protection for those kinds of operations is significant. It means that there was a direct contact with the United States. Panama was a place you could depend on to do the setup for the Iran-Contra transactions. I think, however, the most interesting thing is going to be that Noriega, as the intelligence man, was in the catbird seat during all this period of time, during all the 80s, when all of this illegal activity was going on by the United States, the off-the-books government activities. He was in a perfect position to observe what was going on. If anybody knows the real truth of Iran-Contra, it may be General Noriega, and he has a lot of stories to tell, but as a good intelligence man, he has not told them yet. If he really knows those stories, he's holding them to the point where they will be most useful, most powerful to use against the United States government.
John Dinkins is my guest, and he's a foreign editor at National Public Radio and author of a new book about Noriega called Our Man in Panama. Now, you suggest that the United States used Noriega in the war against communism at the expense of the war against drugs. I mean, now here we are, you know, about to put him on trial for his involvement in the drug trade. And well, you're saying that the United States kind of let him participate in drug deals because we were using him in the war against communism.
The big question is, why did it take so long for us to turn against Noriega?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer, to my mind, is that he was very useful to us in our ideological crusade in Central America. I kind of draw a little picture to illustrate this. Every U.S. agency is represented in Panama, the Pentagon, the CIA, the military intelligence, the embassies, the Drug Enforcement Administration. All of these people are in Panama in the 1980s, but they're not looking at Panama. They're standing there with their back to the country, looking at El Salvador, looking at Guatemala, looking at Nicaragua, Honduras, the drug enforcement people, not looking at Panama. They're looking at Colombia. Nobody's paying attention to what's going on under their own feet. And their major agenda is not Panama. It's the war on communism, the war on Nicaragua. And so the willingness to look the other way when suspicions were came up about Noriega was very high. And for years and years after Noriega's, after the charges came out against Noriega, the United States didn't really make an effort to investigate them. In fact, as I tell the story in the book, it's a fascinating picture of low-level law enforcement agents in the Drug Enforcement Administration who get a lead, follow it up, and eventually develop this enormous case against Noriega. It wasn't something that was ordered from the top. Somebody that said, this man is bad. This man we have to investigate. Give me everything you've got. Let's really put all stops out. We've got to find out whether this man is really involved in drugs and run down the suspicions. That's not the way it was. It was police work. And eventually one source led to another, and over a period of several years, we caught the man. It took from the time that, and by the way, I also point out that Noriega's drug trafficking is cyclical. After 1985, there's really no more evidence that is strong that he was involved in significant transshipment of cocaine, those kind of big protection payments from the cartel. So in other words, by the time we catch him for what he did in 82, 83, 84, he hasn't been doing it for 3 or 4 years.
Were you describing all these Americans using Panama not to pay attention to what's happening in Panama, but to have a listening post for other Central American countries? Noriega let the United States do that. He let the United States have CIA operations based in Panama in violation of the Panama Canal Treaty.
And he was cooperating with those. He was part of those operations. He was getting several hundred thousand dollars a year for those kind of joint operations through his G2 Intelligence Command and the CIA. There was an enormous amount of cooperation. That's why even though he was considered to be unsavory and a lot of people kind of laughed at him because he was this ugly little man, still he was so useful that they went along with him.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is John Dinges, and he's a foreign editor at National Public Radio and author of a new book about General Noriega called Our Man in Panama. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Dinges is my guest. We're talking about Manuel Noriega, the subject of his new book, Our Man in Panama. Well, our president, George Bush, is a former head of the CIA. What's the history of Bush's relationship with Noriega? Noriega was the head of intelligence in his country, Bush the head of intelligence here.
Yeah, you can go back to 1976, the year that Bush was head of the CIA. What's happening in Panama? The United States, for the first time, this is the Ford administration, has gotten serious about canal negotiations. We're moving fairly rapidly toward a treaty. The trouble is that Ronald Reagan is running for president, and he is saying, we bought it, we paid for it, it's ours, and leading a conservative charge against the treaties. Panama tries to increase the, turn up the pressure. There are some bombings in the canal zone. The first time that there's terrorist activities inside the canal zone, obviously to demonstrate to the United States, if you don't sign a treaty with us, there's going to be hell to pay. You're going to have a hard time protecting this canal because we can do this anytime we want. U.S. intelligence identifies Noriega's men as the ones who carried out these bombings. So Noriega comes up to Washington to meet with George Bush to essentially to answer to this. But George Bush's only real concern is, are you a communist? Is Omar Torrijos a communist? And given those assurances that they are ideological friends, and Noriega gives assurances, well, we didn't do it, but we won't do it again in terms of the bombings, and they part friends. Now, at this time, George Bush is the director of Central Intelligence. I list a whole variety of reports that were available to him, including a report that Noriega had penetrated U.S. Espionage operations in Panama and had taken the entire set of transcripts of U.S. bugging operations in Panama and had and knew exactly everything that had been intercepted by the United States. Some people think he even turned some of this information over to Cuba. So it was extremely compromising because he was able to figure out who we were spying on all over Latin America. That was known to Bush at the time of that meeting. And as we all know, the relationship did not change an iota between the Central Intelligence Agency and Noriega.
Do you think that anything will come out of the Noriega trial that will embarrass Bush?
I think a lot that will come out will be embarrassing to the administration. Not necessarily about George Bush personally, because the extent of their personal relationship, I think, is probably quite small, except for the case I just described to you. But Noriega's ability to embarrass the United States, to reveal details of our skullduggery in Central America for the past 10 years, I think is very great. I think he has a big chest of documents squirreled away, of information that could be very compromising for the United States. This is information, I think, that will be on the order of the Iran-Contra revelations.
Well, then why do you think that Bush gave his permission for the invasion of Panama and for the putting of Noriega on trial, knowing that, that the administration really stands to be very embarrassed by the information that comes out?
Well, I think it's one more example of the marvelous ways in which the United States government operates. For better or for worse, it is a system that kind of operates according to the rules in spite of itself in many cases. It wasn't George Bush that indicted Manuel Noriega. It was a U.S. attorney, Leon Kellner, down in Miami. And for a variety of circumstances, it was very difficult for anybody higher up in the administration to say, well, sure, you've got the evidence on him, but let's not indict him for national security reasons. It was impossible, given the climate of the country, coming on the heels of the Iran-Contra affair, even coming on the heels of a spectacular case in which the very U.S. attorney, Leon Kellner, had been accused of having gone easy on some Iran-Contra indictments. It would have been impossible for the United States, for the presidency, to have said, oh, well, Leon Kellner, let's go easy on Noriega. He's only a drug trafficker, but national security is more important. It was circumstantially impossible. We had to enforce this case in order to preserve the integrity of the U.S. system.
Let me get back to Noriega's trial for a moment. Since there is this possibility that information that would really embarrass the administration would come out during the trial, do you think there's any chance that there'll be a plea bargain or something like that that would prevent the type of interrogation that would release this information?
Certainly that's a possibility. I don't think there's... this would mean that Noriega would go along with this. So we would have to offer him a pretty good deal. How much jail time would this man have to serve in order to keep quiet? That's a really interesting question. How little jail time could the administration get away with offering him in exchange for his silence that would not in itself be so outrageous that the American people would react against it? You will have noticed that the administration has not ruled out a plea bargain, and I find that very interesting.
Is there a moral of the story here in how the United States handled Noriega?
Well, I think this is an amorality tale. The United States has no high moral ground in dealing with Noriega. We dealt with this man We paid him. We used him. He used us. And then for us to then suddenly say that because of his crimes, he's the blackest soul in all of Latin America deserving of an invasion, I think is rank hypocrisy. Noriega, on the other hand, is somebody whose actions are indefensible. Notwithstanding his particular crimes, the fact that he held on to power, that he would not compromise, that he led his country down the path until first to economic ruin because of the standing up to the U.S. sanctions, and then finally provoking an invasion that he could have avoided by negotiating his way out of power 6 months, a year earlier. He basically, there was no outcome, and he basically took his country down to ruin along with himself. And I think that his own country, even those who might be favorably disposed to the military, will judge him very harshly for that.
John, you recently got back from Panama. You were there 2 weeks ago. What's the legacy of the U.S. invasion of Panama for the people there?
Well, the signs of the invasion are everywhere. The country is essentially paralyzed commercially, and particularly in Panama City and in Colón, the two largest cities. Almost 50% of the stores are still closed because of the looting that was rampant after the invasion. U.S. troops are patrolling the streets in concert with some of the members of the Panama Defense Forces. Essentially, the U.S., it looks, when you see it, it looks like the Americans are guarding the Panamanians who are guarding the streets. No one trusts the Panamanian Defense Forces. They're very afraid of the United States leaving. It seems to me like this is an occupation that's going to go on for quite a while. At the same time, the demand for U.S. aid is very, very, very high. The Panamanians applaud us, but they hold us responsible for bringing them back on their feet. 12,000 people lost their homes in the middle of Panama City. Those people are holed up at a refugee camp in an old airport hangar, a U.S. air base. They are sitting there now 2 months, eating two meals a day. They're very anxious to get their homes back. They say the United States has to give us our homes back. The important thing to also keep in mind in my observations in Panama is a mood of optimism in the country. People are quite upbeat, even though unemployment is rampant. Many people still have not gone back to work because the shops aren't open again. But still, they feel that they've gotten through this nightmare, that it's over, that the country is going to pull itself back together with U.S. help, and that it really is going to work out okay. I mean, people are very optimistic and certainly much happier. It was a very bitter country in my previous trips before the invasion, and bitter whichever side of the political spectrum you were on. People were very unhappy, and now equally on both sides of the spectrum, people are much more optimistic.
Now that Noriega's gone. Well, John Dinges, thank you very much for talking with us about Noriega.
You're welcome. It's nice talking to you.
John Dinges is a foreign editor at National Public Radio and author of a new book about Noriega called Our Man in Panama. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Francine Duplessis-Gray on how glasnost is affecting the lives of Soviet women. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Everyone loved Peter Riegert's character of Sam the Pickle Man in the movie Crossing Delancey. But he's a lot less lovable in his new film, A Shock to the System. He plays a young executive clawing his way up the corporate ladder. Coming up, a talk with Peter Riegert. Also, rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of the harmony group, The Five Keys. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Tom Hanks' new comedy, Joe vs. the Volcano. It was written and directed by John Patrick Shanley, the same man who wrote Moonstruck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The West German Parliament today adopted a resolution calling for a unified Germany to honor Poland's western border and calling on East Germany to make the same declaration. The statement says a unified Germany should sign a border treaty on the basis of these declarations. During debate, there were charges that West German Chancellor Kohl has endangered the unification process by his handling of the border issue. A nonpartisan citizens' committee in East Germany has accused a leading conservative politician of working for Stasi, the former state security service. Deidre Berger reports.
A citizens' committee in Rostock, East Germany, said it had proof that lawyer Wolfgang Schnoor worked for the secret police until last fall. The group said it had files that showed Schnoor received awards for his work from top communist officials. Schnoor, head of the opposition group Democratic Awakening, denied the charges and claimed the files were a fabrication. In East Berlin, the leaders of Democratic Awakening said they accepted Schnoor's word of honor that he was not a secret police informer. Democratic Awakening is part of a conservative coalition for East German parliamentary elections that has been heavily supported by West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl's Conservative Party. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
Hundreds of demonstrators besieged several town halls around London tonight to protest a new tax being levied by the government of Prime Minister Thatcher. Riot police were called in, and there were reports of arrest and looting. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
The poll tax is a new tax being enacted by the Thatcher government, which will replace the property tax on houses with a head tax on people. As a result, many people will see a doubling and tripling of their tax bills, and protests have been going on throughout Britain. Tonight, in the largest and most violent demonstration thus far, in the London community of Hackney, hundreds of people tried to break into the local town hall where the new tax was being determined. Bottles and bats flew, mounted riot police were called in, and several people were injured. 30 people were arrested, and there were reports of looting. Other protests occurred in Camden Town and elsewhere in London. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher has condemned the violence and blamed the protests on the Labour Party, who in turn blame her for the unpopular poll tax. I'm Jackie Lydon in London.
The White House has confirmed that President Bush was tricked into taking a telephone call from a man that he thought was Iranian President Rafsanjani to talk about the hostages, but the caller turned out to be an imposter. The call was first reported by CBS. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 26.5 points to close at 2,696.17 on volume of some 171 million shares. Trading was active as advancing issues led declines. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The Black Harmony group known as the Five Keys had a rise that was similar to many contemporary groups, but rock and roll historian Ed Ward says their breakup had an unusual twist.
A rose must remain with the sun and the rain, and its lovely promise won't come true. To each his own, to each his own, and my own is you.
It's become something of a cliché that the success of the early Black Harmony groups was hindered by racism, that the sales of their records was curtailed by white groups doing cover versions for major labels with better distribution and access to the airwaves, and that since black groups recorded for small labels, they didn't have the chance they should have had, all of which is true in some cases. But did you ever hear the story of the black harmony group that was ruined by success? The Five Keys started in Newport News, Virginia, in the same old stereotyped way. They sang together in church and on gospel programs, calling themselves the Sentimental Four. They added a fifth member, and, inspired by the example of the Orioles, they went secular. From 1949 to 1951, they toured with a variety show called Miller's Brown Skin Models on what was left of the black vaudeville circuit. And early in 1951, they played Amateur Night at Harlem's Apollo Theater, beating out 31 other acts to win the prize. Eddie Messner of Aladdin Records was in the audience, and before long, the Five Keys were in the studio. It took them a couple of tries, but in the summer of 1951, people were slow dancing to the Five Keys' number one R&B record, The Glory of Love.
You've got to give a little, take a little,
West had one of those one-in-a-million voices, but he was drafted and spent 1952 to 1954 in the Army. The group had struggled on without him, without much success, until the summer of 1954, when Dave Cavanaugh of Capitol Records, a label not known for hip black music in those days, signed the group. Their first record for Capitol was a novelty, and sort of a racist one at that, but it cracked not only the rhythm and blues charts, but the pop charts as well.
Try some okumbu, diet. Try some okumbu.
I went to Chinatown, way back in old Hong Kong, to get some egg foo young. And then I heard a gong. Ling ting tong, got to sing that song called Try some okumbu, diet. Try some okumbu.
So Rudy West came out of the Army finding his group doing real well. And Marilyn Pierce, who sang on Ling Ting Tong, was established as a second lead voice. Still, Capitol was glad to have West back, and he sang on the group's next release.
Close your eyes. Take a deep breath. Open your heart. And whisper.
I love you. I love you. I love you.
Tell me you love me.
Close Your Eyes was pretty avant-garde for 1955, but black record buyers snapped it up. What happened next is hard to figure, though. The Five Keys continued to record great records, but these records didn't sell. In mid-1956, Capitol changed the group's direction, and the first record they did that way was a pop and R&B hit. But listen to it.
Out of sight, out of mind. So the story goes, you forgot I exist. My broken heart knows, out of sight, out of mind.
That's Rudy West, all right, but unless the other four Keys have had operations, that's a studio group singing behind him. The next Five Keys record, Wisdom of a Fool, only made it on the white pop charts, very unusual for a black harmony group in 1956, as did the next one, Let There Be You. I bet you can figure out why.
Let there be light, and there was a light. Let there be earth. And there was earth. If I had my way, I would ask of him, please let there be you.
Let There Be You is the prelude to the Five Keys' first Capitol album, which was filled with songs that sounded a lot more like Capitol's other black success story, Nat King Cole, than it did like the Five Keys. They'd strayed from their roots, and although they were doing very well, playing supper club engagements and the like, Rudy West knew what time it was and retired in 1958, the moment the group's capital contract ran out. The Five Keys had had nearly every opportunity, nearly every advantage a white pop act would have. Hoping perhaps for more than they could get, they made compromises, perhaps urged on by bad management, perhaps not. The group that had helped usher in the great era of black group harmony watched that era pass it by.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. She's gone. I built a nest for a sweet little pigeon, but she flapped her wings and flew. Whoa, I built a nest for a sweet little pigeon, cause I thought that she'd be true. Whoa, she left for me, didn't say goodbye. That ain't my fault, at least I tried. I built a nest for a sweet little... This is Fresh Air. Before he played Sam the Pickle Man in the film Crossing Delancey, Peter Riegert was best known for his co-starring role with Burt Lancaster in Bill Forsyth's offbeat film Local Hero. Riegert played a young American oil company executive who travels to a coastal Scottish town to convince the residents to sell their land to the oil company. Riegert is in a new film called A Shock to the System. It stars Michael Caine as an ad company executive. Riegert plays an ambitious young ad man climbing his way up the corporate ladder. On the way up, he steps over Michael Caine and gets the promotion Caine wanted.
This isn't exactly comfortable for me. I know you wanted this job. I suppose if we were rival princes, I could just have you killed. Save a lot of politics.
It's not that easy to kill someone and get away with it.
I thought instead it would be good if we could get together this weekend. Out at the house, you and Leslie, me and Tara.
Oh, the actual Tara. Yes, that would be nice, Bob.
Good. We'll do a little sailing, a lot of eating, and find the time to discuss the new order of things. Graham, do you happen to have a light?
Yes, of course.
Are you playing the kind of person that you don't like in this new movie?
You didn't like this character? I thought he was charming. No, I don't make a value judgment. I just really... I don't think an actor can really decide beforehand that a character is likable or not. You just play the character and fulfill the functions that the job requires. And if people like or dislike that character, it's probably related to what the story is.
Now, you played opposite Michael Caine in this. Now, he's the kind of actor who, it seems to me, takes nearly every role that he's offered. He seems to make so many movies a year. But it seems to me that you've taken the kind of opposite route from Michael Caine of doing much fewer films.
Not by design.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I try and get work and make choices to do jobs based on what I'm sent. You know, people are only seeing 10% of the things I do. There's theater and television as well, so.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about a previous role that you had as Sam Posner, the pickle man in Crossing Delancey. And you played, a man who sells pickles on New York's Lower East Side, has very kind of traditional values, and meets with Amy Irving through a matchmaker. And you initially seem a little conventional for her.
I heard you and Marilyn had a good time.
Yeah.
There's a little reception Saturday night at the bookstore. I thought maybe you two would like to...
Going to a baseball game Saturday.
Maybe I could be handling this better.
Handling what? What are you handling, me?
I don't blame you for being...
You come to my stand, you invite me out to dinner, you set me up with your girlfriend, you get your bubby to drag me over here, a guy could get a little tired of this routine.
I did not...
What's the problem here? You think it's so small, my world? You think it's so provincial? You think it defines me? Is that it?
No. No, I don't.
Did you have any empathy with the role?
Oh, yeah, a lot of empathy, sure. It's a very sympathetic character. And, different than what I'm used to, I think we're all used to seeing. Somebody who is what's the right word? Well, sympathetic. In a very low key way.
Well, the character you play in Yiddish would be called a mensch. You know, someone, a good boy with good values.
I think it has larger. There are more implications as well. It means it's a very large term. It doesn't only mean, you know, a good boy.
Right. Okay. You know, you describe it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's loyalty and honor and courage and, mm-hmm. and her. I mean, it's a very. The implications for me are grand. They're not. It's a great compliment to be called a mensch. Let's put it that way.
Now, are you from a Jewish background yourself?
Mm-hmm.
You taught before you started acting.
Mm-hmm.
How did you end up in teaching?
Well, I needed a job. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I had spent about 4 years or 5 years working as a social worker of a kind. I mean, I hadn't studied for it, but I worked for the University Settlement House on the Lower East Side in various capacities. So I felt I might be able to make some contribution. I can't say it was a career move because I didn't think in those terms. It was something for me to do at the time. And after about a year and a half, I sort of felt, well, I'm really not a teacher. And I shouldn't be here. So I left.
After you decided to leave teaching and you had to figure out what to do next,
mm-hmm.
How did acting become your next choice?
I'm loath to use the word epiphany, but I suspect it was something like that. I mean, there was no logical thought that went with it. I just woke up and said, well, I have to do this.
Is it something you'd wanted to do but had repressed all
Well, I had friends who were trying to be actors, and I had been going to the theater in New York since I was a kid. I just never made the connection that it was a legitimate way to earn a living. And then by the time I was 23, I thought, I mean, I really did just get up and say, okay, you've got to try this.
Did you have any experience at all? Had you been in plays or summer camp productions, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, a play in college and a play in high school. It's not remotely what it is to be an actor, but you get it's like a taste.
Mm-hmm. So where did you decide to study?
Well, at the time, I didn't have any money to study, so I just pretty much picked up the trade papers that existed in the various newsstands and started auditioning. And then I got involved with an improvisational company called War Babies in 1972, and I stayed with them for 8 years. So that was really what my training was.
What were the first auditions that you went to?
The first audition I went to was probably the first week in January of 1971 at an off Broadway theater on East 4th Street off of the Bowery, off of 3rd Avenue, in a building in which I don't remember there being a roof because there seemed to be snow in the room where we were auditioning, and everybody was wearing winter coats, and I thought, this is the theater? This is something wrong here. So that's where I started auditioning, places like that. Closets with seats.
For what kind of roles?
Anything. I mean, I played in anything. Mostly they were new plays. It's hard to think back to what the specific parts were, but they were always, there were drugs always present in as a theme, you know.
Now, your first movie role was in Animal House?
That's the first part. I did a short film that I co-produced with a friend of mine, and I also had two scenes without any dialogue in a movie called Coma.
Oh, I remember Coma, yeah. I remember the ad campaign.
I wasn't in that.
Right.
I was hardly in the movie.
Right, okay.
But I got to watch, you know, go to MGM, I think it was made. And I think Michael Douglas and Genevieve Bugeaud were the stars, and I played a doctor who was watching an operation that failed or something.
So you just had a walk-on part, basically?
I was just standing there. I didn't have an entrance or an exit. I just stood and watched, you know.
No,
moved my eyes a bit too much, but...
Now, how did you get the role in Animal House? And describe your role again.
I played a character named Boone, who was the... I think I was the social director. I think that's what my responsibility was. And I had an audition. And I think I auditioned about four times, and then I got the job.
Were you noticed in the movie right away? Did that was
in Animal House?
Yeah.
Well, I certainly got a good response from it. I mean, when it came out, I think I probably could have gotten room and board in any town in the country. It was very, very usually successful movie. But at the time, there weren't, like, there seem to be many movies now in which young people get to play important parts, if not star in them. That wasn't the case in 1978, so there really wasn't much for me to go into, as I recall, even though Animal House was so successful. So it's basically, it was a bit misleading for me. It was the first real movie that I was in, and it was an enormous hit. Not, that's what I thought you did. Well, you went to work and made movies, and they were successful. And I learned immediately after that that that's not the case. So I can't say anything dramatic happened, but it, you know, it legitimizes what you do, and it helped.
So do you still have to audition for roles, or at this point do people just call you up and invite you to take a part?
Well, I'm still asked to audition. I'm loath to do it these days, mainly because after 20 years you can act or you can't act, and I think that a director, if he has the power to hire me, will learn as much about me and what I can do sitting in a room as they would an audition. I've sort of lost the understanding of what an audition's function is, viscerally. When I was younger, an audition was tantamount to a job. Just getting an audition was difficult. So I put so much emotion into it. Now maybe I'm just more cynical about it, but I don't see its value in terms of me being hired. And I think that's true of all actors with some experience. It's too much is made of it. It's not a helpful tool. Obviously, if you have no experience, maybe that's a way for somebody to get to meet a new actor. But you probably can learn as much, if not more, in a meeting.
Okay, well, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Actor Peter Riegert, he co-stars with Michael Caine in the new film, A Shock to the System. It opens later this month. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the opening of John Poindexter's Iran-Contra trial?
Nina Totenberg is there watching the trial for us, Terry. Opening statements have already started. Oliver North is scheduled to be the first witness in John Poindexter's trial, witness for the prosecution. We have a piece on Vermont and their discussion of whether that state ought to secede from the Union and become another country, and a profile tonight of Dr. Janetta Cole. She's the president of Spelman College in Atlanta. It's a historically black college just for women. It's a very popular place just now. This college is enjoying a real renaissance.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Patrick Shanley first established his reputation as an off-Broadway playwright. Then he wrote several screenplays which got produced, Five Corners, January Man, and Moonstruck. Shanley's latest screen venture is Joe vs. the Volcano, which stars Tom Hanks. Shanley not only wrote the movie, this time he also directs. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
After his screenplay for Moonstruck won the Academy Award, John Patrick Shanley was one of Hollywood's hottest properties, and with reason. Even though rumors flew about how the director, Norman Jewison, had salvaged Shanley's messy script, Moonstruck was undeniably something special. And that specialness had a lot to do with the way the characters talked. They seemed to be uttering their feelings with an unashamed directness that was at once comical and enormously moving. But what happens when Shanley applies the same approach to people who have no feelings, who aren't even characters? The result is an endless, cutesy babble. And its name is Joe versus the Volcano. You want cute? Listen to this plot. Joe is a hypochondriac with a horrible clerking job, and one day his doctor tells him he has only 3 or 4 months to live. The next day, a tycoon shows up at his house with an offer, the tycoon owns the mining rights to a distant South Seas island. And in order to keep those rights, he needs to find someone willing to propitiate the tribal gods by jumping into the island's exceedingly active volcano. Since Joe is going to die anyway, why doesn't he take the tycoon's credit cards, live the life of Riley for a few days, then hop a boat manned by the tycoon's luscious daughter, and go to the island and jump into that volcano? Great idea, says Joe, and off he goes. Now, this is the sort of mildly Faustian goo that Depression audiences went for. You know the routine. A poor boy gets to be rich beyond his wildest dreams, but he has to pay in the end. And in the end, he realizes money isn't everything. Still, no matter how icky those 30s and 40s fantasies were, they at least addressed themselves to human concerns. Joe versus the Volcano refuses to. As Joe, Tom Hanks is sassy and funny and sweet, but he never seems to be a person. Just listen to this scene as he's about to jump into the volcano, and the tycoon's daughter, played by Meg Ryan, has just declared her love for him.
You love me?
Yes, I love you. I can feel my heart. I feel like I'm going crazy. You just can't die and leave me here on the stinking earth without you.
I've got to do it.
Why? Why? The chief doesn't even want you to do it. Do you, chief?
Because I have wasted my entire life, and I'm going to die. Now I have a chance to die like a man, and I'm going to take it. I've got to take it.
I love you.
I love you, too. I've never been in love with anybody before either. It's great. I am glad. But the timing stinks. I gotta go.
This is all just ducky, except for one thing. If a character doesn't particularly care whether he lives or dies or falls in love or gets rich, then we don't either. The people in this movie aren't even substantial enough to be called cartoons. The Roadrunner and Bugs Bunny at least faced death with some comprehension of what it meant. Joe faces it as though it were a plot twist. The movie has its pleasantly whimsical moments, and Meg Ryan plays three roles, which gives you a chance to see all the darling little things she can do with her mouth. But still, as a first-time director, Shanley looks every inch the first-time director, indulging himself with fancy crane shots and lavishing wet George de la Rue music on every frame. As for his screenplay, well, Joe versus the Volcano is clearly the work of a man who loves to hear himself write.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Francine Duplessis-Gray tells us how Glasnost has and hasn't changed the lives of Soviet women. Also, film director Catherine Bigelow tells us what it's like being a woman in the man's world of action films. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.